Well, Ken, you only had two songs to do it in, but you came up with a pretty good song service for tonight's lesson, which is a continuation of imitating this love that we're talking about in 1 Peter chapter 1. This love that gives us purpose, this love that makes us into the fully formed man of God that God desires. We talked about how that love comes down. First of all, it comes from this place of wanting to imitate God's holiness, wanting to come away from the lust that used to ensnare us. How this love is ultimately about perfecting our fear of God so that we see Him with the love, the reverence, the respect, and even to some degree the terror that keeps us as we should be. And that ultimately what we derive from understanding that the man of God focuses his attention on the brethren is a purity of heart and a purity of purpose. And we sort of ended this morning by sojourning over in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, if you'll be turning there. And tonight, we're going to be focusing on the latter half of 1 Corinthians 13. We asked the question this morning, why is love so important? And we, of course, looked at the first few verses of 1 Corinthians 13 where Paul says that if he spoke with the tongues of men and of angels, or if he had faith that he could move mountains, or if he gave all of his possessions to the poor and his body to be burned, that ultimately none of that would profit him anything. It would be of no value to either him or God. That did not come from this place of love. But after he begins to give those characteristics of love in verse 4 that says love is patient, love is kind, and is not jealous, love does not brag, it is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, it does not take into an account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. And we were at the end of the lesson this morning, we were talking about what it means, and we're going to come back to that at the end of the lesson tonight, what it means that love never fails. And I think sometimes we get this idea that it's kind of like the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love, that if you got love, everything's going to work out. And while that is a true sentiment, that because of God's love, everything is going to work out, what we have to see is what Paul is commending us to here is an imitation of God's love. So he's not really saying that because of love, everything is going to work out. What he is saying is we need a love that does not give up. And when you look at what he said in the preceding verse, after saying that it does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in truth, he says love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. And I would say to you that that is the very portrait of a love that does not fail. It is a love that is actively bearing, believing, hoping, and enduring, so that whenever we are called to love, or we are always called to love, but whenever we are engaged in this love, that it is a love that continues even in the middle of deep difficulty. What does it mean that love bears all things, that it believes all things, that it hopes all things, that it endures all things? If we were going to imitate that kind of love, who would we look like? Are there examples that we can go and look at in Scripture where we see this kind of love? And the first thing I want to point out, if you've ever tried to sort of look at that list and get to the heart of it, you probably notice a lot of overlap between those words, don't you? That bears all things and endures all things seem very similar. In fact, it's kind of hard to say where one stops and the other begins. Hopes all things and believes all things sound very similar to one another. But I want to, before I get into characters we could look at, I want to turn over to one other passage that informs us about the kind of love that we ought to desire to have. And that's Ephesians chapter 5. After warning the church in Ephesus, or after commending them to one another and commending them to be joined together and commending them to the love of God in chapter 3 and the love of Christ that defies our ability to comprehend, he gives them warnings about going back to their old manner of life. He gives them warnings about anger. He gives them warnings about malice and deceit, just like he did over in 1 Peter chapter 2. And then he says this in chapter 5, verse 1. Keeping in mind that he has just told them we cannot continue to be the way the world is. We cannot go back to what we were before. So what do we replace that with? Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. You know what there's no room for in love? That perfect love of 1 Corinthians 13, that perfect imitation of love of Jesus and the perfect imitation of the love of God in Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. Nowhere in that list does love stop and consider what is good for me. I want you to think for a moment. What would the grand old story that we just sang about, Ken, what would that look like if Jesus had stopped and said, selfishly, what do I want out of this? Well, it would have looked like the other side of 10,000 angels. That's what it would have looked like. The Hebrew writer said it was for the joy that was set before him that he looked at the cross, despising the shame, seated at the right hand of God. The joy that was set before him was the abiding, love-filled, love-based relationship that he is calling us into. Our ability, our opportunity to imitate the love of God to the best of our ability and have it mean something is only exists because somebody, one person, loved so selflessly that his answer the night before he went to the cross is not my will, but your will be done. That's how you get to a kind of love that hangs on a cross and says, Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. Does that feel like big shoes to fill? It can be done. Not perfectly. Not on the grandiose scale that Jesus sacrificed himself, but we can engage in a love every day that takes our good and sets it aside and looks to our brethren and serves. And that's how you navigate the time of testing and the trial of faith that's producing the refined gold of our faith that Peter talks about. That's how you make it through the difficult times where it seems like the trials and tribulations of life are affecting brethren at different times and different ways to different and varying degrees without malice and hypocrisy and deceit and slander and anger. Is everybody in the equation is trying to love like Jesus loved? But when I think about a love that bears all things, I think about loving the way Barnabas loved. In Acts chapter 4, it's the first introduction that we have of Barnabas. This is after Peter and John are arrested for preaching in the temple. It says in verse 32, "And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and one soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own. But all things were common property to them." Remember, there's a whole bunch of people staying in the city that were there. They were just there for Pentecost. They didn't know they were going to be converted to Christ on that random Pentecost that they had come to the city. Well, now they're wanting to stay among the believers. They need to learn. They need to be built up. There's a lot of need. "But all things were common property to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all. For there was not a needy person among them, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sale and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as any had need. Now Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles," which translated means "sons of encouragement," "and who owned a tract of land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet." Do you know what it just said Barnabas did there? It said he looked down among his brethren and there's a whole bunch of need there. But there's also, God has given him the opportunity to meet that need. He takes what is his. He's never going to have it again. He sells it. And rather than keeping it, he goes and gives it to the people who can do the good with it that needs to be done. You know, it occurs to me as I was preparing this lesson, Barnabas may have never known the names of the people that he helped. The apostles obviously gave him recognition, because this is likely not the only form of encouragement that Barnabas was engaged in. In fact, we know it's not. The next time we see Barnabas, he's fishing Paul out of Tarsus and bringing him over and beginning the first missionary journey. And before that, he's introducing Paul to the apostles so that he can even be received by the church in Jerusalem. What's he doing? He's taking somebody else's burdens, as we've talked about so many times in this series from Galatians 6. And he's saying, "Your hardship, your difficulty, your struggle, the thing that might cause your faith to wane, I'm taking ownership of that so that you can focus." That's love bearing all things. But not only does love bear all things, love has faith. That's the idea of believes all things. It doesn't just mean that somebody comes and tells me something and I inherently believe it because I love them. It means I don't lose faith in them. Even at times when they may not be on the right path, if they're my brother or sister in Christ, I'm going to keep my faith in them. I'm going to hope and pray. It's where faith or believing and hope kind of sound like the same thing. I'm going to hope and pray and work for their restoration, because I believe it's possible. I believe that the gospel is the power of God to salvation because of what Romans 1 and 17 says, "For the Jew first and also for the Greek, and in it the righteousness of God is revealed." I believe that the Apostle Paul, who said that he was the rankest sinner, the chief of sinners, said it is a faithful saying that Jesus came into the world to save sinners. We need to have the kind of love that doesn't lose faith in our brethren just because they're not where they ought to be. We don't give up on them. We don't divide from them. We don't separate from them. Maybe it's the hardships of this world, or maybe it's the testing of their faith. But we don't ever become like the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son. We become more like the father, who's waiting and anticipating and ready to help. And you know where you see a really good example of that is in the story of Ruth. You didn't think I was going to go Old Testament on you, did you? Ruth has a pretty sad beginning. Naomi loses her two sons, and her husband dies. And that she had been in the land of Moab, sojourning there because of a famine in the land. And Now she's turning to go home because there is no place for her. She has nobody to care for her. She has her two daughters-in-laws. And it says in verse 6 of chapter 1, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-laws that she might return from the land of Moab, for they heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and was giving them food. So she departed," verse 7, "from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me.'" Basically, Naomi is telling her daughters-in-law, one of them being Ruth, "I'm releasing you from your bond. You have done a kind thing for an old woman. You've traveled with her on a dangerous journey. I'm letting you go home. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. And they said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. And if I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of God has gone forth against me." And they lifted up voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And this is where this gets good. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods, and return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." And of course, we know the rest of that story and how it works out, don't we? Can I ask you something? What is Ruth hanging on to there? I mean, Naomi made a pretty good case for going home, didn't she? She said, "If I had a husband tonight and I was still fertile, if I had sons tomorrow morning, you gonna wait till they're old enough to marry them?" Naomi's in a low spot. And what Ruth says is that her commitment was not just to Naomi. Her commitment was to the God of Naomi. And Ruth is swearing by the name of God, "Let God kill me if I die anywhere other than where you die, Naomi." She is swearing by the name of God that she is not going to give up on her. You know what that is? That's faith. Not just faith that this is that Naomi is worth holding on to, but faith that God holds and upholds those who are striving to do it His way. That's why that verse gets read in so many weddings. "Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your God will be my God and your people, my people." What is she saying? "I am committed to being faithful to you." Is that how we feel about our brethren? "You're my people. We have the same God. Your troubles are my troubles. Your heartache is my heartache." That's why we're told to laugh with those who laugh and weep with those who weep. It's that same kind of love. And we don't do near enough talking about the example that we see in places like Ruth of that kind of love. But faithfulness of love is what makes love worth anything. That's the first thing we learn about God's love. Romans chapter 5 tells us that God loved us that even when we were enemies, Christ died for the ungodly. He says, for a righteous man, nobody's going to die. For a man who's got a good reputation that people love, somebody might die for him. But you want to see the faithfulness of God's love? While we were sinners, Christ died for us. There's nothing deserving. There's no way that Naomi is ever going to be able to repay. A young woman who doesn't know what the end of the story is going to look like. She's just trusting in God. She doesn't know what the end of the story is going to look like. There's no way that Naomi can ever repay that kind of love. But their lives both turn on the fact that Ruth wouldn't let go. There may be some in our number whose lives will turn one day on whether or not their brethren let go of them. You can't build that kind of love when it's needed. You have to build it before the difficult day comes. But not only does love bear and believe all things, we're told love hopes all things. You want to see a good example of that? Turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 20. 1 Samuel chapter 20, Jonathan is stuck between a rock and a hard place. He loves his friend David. There's a cool story in 1 Samuel 13. In just the previous chapter, or in the same chapter, it tells us that there weren't any swords in Israel because there wasn't anybody to make. The Philistines had basically taken all the blacksmiths. So Jonathan had a sword, and Saul had a sword. And when Jonathan meets David and he finds that he's a kindred spirit, he gives him the robe of the son of the king and he takes off his sword and he gives it to David. They were friends right from the beginning. And not just, hey buddy, what are you doing? They loved each other. It was a deep, manly, but deep kind of love. Well, by the time you get to 1 Samuel chapter 20, Saul has already tried to kill David twice. David has slain Goliath. David's getting the accolades that Saul feels like he deserves. And so you have this story. We're going to start in the middle of it. David's not wanting to go to a feast. He knows what Saul is about by this point. Jonathan isn't sure. So they work out this agreement between themselves. Here's what we're going to do. David's going to delay till the second or the third day until I can get a straight answer from Dad. And then I'm going to send David a warning about what's going on, whether it's safe to come back or whether he just needs to run. And this is the last interaction that we know of between David and Jonathan. It says in verse 8, therefore deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant with the Lord with you. But if there is any iniquity in me, put me to death. For why then should you bring me to your father? That's how David's saying. Jonathan, if you're part of this plan, and it's because you find evil in me, then I would rather you kill me than take me to your dad. Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? Basically, he said, Jonathan, hadn't you figured it out? Anybody that's on my side, your dad's going to kill. So you're going to have to figure, and he actually does try to kill Jonathan at one point. He says, you're going to have to figure out then how you're going to get word to me, because you may be dead. Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers harshly? And Jonathan said to David, come and let us go into the field. So both of them went out into the field. And then Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness when I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day. Behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it pleases my father to do you harm, may the Lord... Listen to what he says here. If my father, David, wants to do you harm, then may God do so to Jonathan and more, even more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, will you not show me? Here's all I'm going to ask for this, David. Show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die, that you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And you know who Jonathan knew an enemy of David was at that point? His dad. He says, here's what I'm asking, David. I may not survive this, but I know you're going to survive this because God has said you're going to survive this. So here's what I want you to do. Just remember me. That's all I'm asking. Don't let them wipe out my whole house. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Do you see the hope in Jonathan there? Jonathan's hoping that this all could work out, but that's not the hope I'm talking about. He's saying, David, I trust in the Lord. You trust in the Lord. The only thing I'm asking is if the Lord does to your enemies what he will do to your enemies, that you don't forget me. Do we hope like that? There are brethren that struggle with impossible situations, that struggle with impossible burdens of sin, the likes of which none of us may even be able to imagine. But Jonathan is, because of hope, is going to become an advocate, because he believes what God said about David. He's going to become an advocate for his friend in the court of his father. And I suspect Jonathan knew how it was going to work out at the end of the day. I don't think he wanted to really admit to it. Brothers and sisters, one of the things that love does is it helps those that we love face hardship with hope. That goes back to bearing all things. But we help those that we love face hardship with hope. David's got a confusing road ahead of him. He's going to be fighting against the armies of Saul at different times. At other times, he's going to be running away from Saul. At other times, he's going to be sparing Saul's life. It's a confusing set of years that are coming up in David's life. He's removed from his friend. And Jonathan says, don't let go of what God has promised. Sometimes more than anything else, that's what our brethren need from us, is to see that we are holding on. In the difficult times, in the frustrating times, in the sad, heartbreaking times, that we are not giving up on what God has promised. And I got to tell you, every parent that has seen a child or every family that has seen a loved one come back and restored to the Lord, that almost every one of those stories has one thing in common. Those who loved did not give up hope that the power of God and the salvation remains in the Word of God. Just like Jonathan was telling David, don't give up hope because God has told you what He's going to do to your enemies. Love endures. It's funny how much love, enduring and bearing all things sound a lot alike. But I think about Jesus in John 13 when he said, I give you this new commandment that you love one another as I have loved you, the commandment that he reiterates in John 15 and 12. In between those two commandments, those two iterations of that love one another commandment, he says in John 14, 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Meaning that tells me that I can learn to be a better burden bearer. But the passage that really strikes me about the enduring love of Jesus is one that I've already referenced three or four times in both of these lessons, and that's Luke 23 and 34. Hanging upon the cross, the people that are surrounding him are already jeering at him, are already cursing his name, are already spitting upon him. And what is he calling out? Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. I have seen a great number of brethren do a great deal of harm to their brethren in anger and in ignorance, and I have seen those that come back from that are always the ones who were willing to go the mile of forgiveness that nobody else could rationalize. And it's kind of like the Hebrew writer talks about in Hebrews chapter 12 when he says, you've not endured yet to the point of bloodshed. I don't care how much we think we have forgiven, we have never forgiven as much as Jesus forgave that day on the cross. Because it is not just the sins of the people gathered around Him, jeering at His name and spitting upon Him and shouting crucify and trying to feed Him with vinegar to give Him that to drink and ripping apart His robes and driving a crown of thorns onto His head. The Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do, is your sin and my sin. Because that's who He was dying for. And if His death is about forgiveness, then surely our lives should be about the endurance of God's forgiveness, because ultimately that's what it means, that love never fails. The way that you build a love that never fails is to realize that faith, hope, and love, they all endure, but the greatest of these is love. Well, why? Faith will one day be sight. Hope will one day be realized. But the one of these that goes on and on and on forever into eternity. And we talked about how mind-blowing eternity was in Bible class this morning. Well, that's love. And I was talking to my dad about this yesterday, and he said something that just had to make it into the sermon. The great thing about love is love makes impossible situations possible. When it endures, when it has faith, when it hopes, when it bears. But I want you to know it said more than just bears, believes, hopes, and endures. It said all things. All things. That's the kind of love we want to strive for. And if we have that kind of love in this congregation, do you know what? You know who's going to see it? Well, we'll see it. But so will everyone who comes through this door. Because that's the kind of congregation of the Lord's people that people want to know more about why you are the way you are. That's the kind of love that brings people to Jesus. And it's the kind of love that holds people together. Do you owe some duty to God this evening? Is your soul not what it ought to be? Have you never put on Jesus in baptism for the forgiveness of sins? Have you wandered away? Could the prayers of the congregation for your strength and endurance help? If any of that applies, come forward confessing your sins as we stand and sing.